On this episode of Still Loading, Mr. Miyamoto makes video game history. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today I am super excited because today on the podcast I have an interview with someone that I'm really excited to share with you. His name is Dexter Morrill, and before we get into the interview, just a little bit of a preamble for it. Dexter is writing a children's book on video game history, and I don't want to say any more than that. I would like him to say it, so I just want to thank Dexter once again for coming onto the podcast kind of last minute, too. I wanted to get this up before his Kickstarter ended, which we will talk about and you will hear in the coming episode. And yeah, so thank you, Dexter, for joining me, and thank you all for listening. So without further ado, here is my interview with Dexter Morrill. Today on the show, I'm really excited because I have a writer, an illustrator, and a teacher of art design with me, and he is working on an upcoming book that's being Kickstarted right now, and I'll let him kind of describe the Kickstarter and what the book is all about. But it's a really cool idea to me, and I think it's a really good idea overall that we should see more of. So today on the podcast, I have Dexter Morrill with me. Dexter, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Thank you. How are you?
I'm tired, but I'm always tired. And what we're kind of going into with this, I'll probably end up being more tired once the baby gets here. But so I had you on because you have this really cool Kickstarter that you started. It just went live as of this recording 3 days ago, or two-ish days ago. Right. So, and it's going all through the month of October. And this episode is going to be released, I want to say, I'm going to release it on Wednesday the 7th. So that's when I should be able to get it out by. So it's still going to have a good chunk of time left. But you started a Kickstarter. And could you explain what the Kickstarter is for? Because I would do it, but I kind of want to hear it from your words, because I think it's a really cool idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm really excited to get this out there. I'm doing, through my research at least, the very first children's book based on video game history, or a specific moment on video game history. In this particular book, we're going to cover Shigeru Miyamoto, the legendary game designer who created and designed the Donkey Kong arcade game and Mario, Zelda, and everything beyond that. But specifically wanted to cover like his first success that led to the designer that we know now, and just kind of format it into a nice story for all ages, for the family, and kind of go beyond that. The goal for this particular Kickstarter is just to get the book printed, because as of right now, it's completely done. It's written, it's illustrated, it's ready to go. But this is the first book I've ever created by myself. So just needed a little bit of help to get it out there. And if it does well, I'd like it to continue as a whole anthology series.
Mm-hmm. So what gave you the inspiration to write a children's book about video games? You did cover this in your Kickstarter video, but for those who have not watched that video or don't know about it, why did you choose, or what inspired you to write a children's book about video game history?
Yeah, well, oh man. In fact, if this does release on October 7th, happy birthday to my son.
Wow, okay.
This is, he's a major reason why this project kind of came to light. A lot of things kind of led up into the, you know, I've got my own kind of background with passion for video games, and specifically video game history. I actually did my master's degree thesis on video game preservation and historical preservation.
Okay.
But the turn into creating a children's book for this is because of my son, who is going to be a year old. And you know, I don't want to be one of those parents that like, you're gonna like Star Wars, you're gonna like the, you know, I don't want to like
Yeah, I gotcha.
back him into a corner. But I also want to be ready if he asks, you know, hey dad, you know, what, where did Mario come from, or Donkey Kong, or those kinds of things. You know, I feel like a children's book is a great way to kind of expose your children and teach them, you know, different stories. So it felt like the perfect combination, especially when I looked into it for him with the interest of like, maybe I can find some kids' books that I can
Yeah.
share with him. And I wasn't finding any for what I was looking for. And, you know, like you said, I'm an illustrator. That's my background, is in art and design. And I was like, I can do this myself. It'll especially be like a special treat, you know, for my son as well. And, you know, why not? If there are other people like me, there might be people who, you know, are either looking for it or didn't know. They were like, oh yeah, this would be something I'd really love to have on my shelf and share with my child as well, you know. So that's kind of, it all kind of snowballed together into this concept.
I would definitely fall into the latter of that. Someone who one I actually saw it through a mutual friend of ours, Game Dave, the YouTuber. He shared it. I went, I never knew I needed this. And I saw it. I was like, this is a great idea. And that's why I wanted to ask you on the show. I wanted to kind of I want to see this happen real bad. So even the small voice that I have on the internet, I want to try to use it to push this forward because I would love to see it. So when you're writing this type of thing, like what was your approach to trying to make video game history accessible for kids? Especially from what I read on the Kickstarter, it's going to be a board book. So how do you that's and that's generally geared towards really younger kids. Like, you know, like you said, your son is going to be turning one on October 7th, right?
Correct.
That's crazy. That's bizarrely perfect timing that I did not know or plan. But how do you kind of write a book on video game history, or what was your technique or method of, unless you don't want to give it away, but
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, part of my profession as a teacher is to give it away. So the approach kind of came from, you know, practicing what I preach to my students. One of the first things you should do when designing something is know your audience. And for me, my audience is, you know, my son sitting on my lap, following along in a book, pointing at the pictures, you know, that kind of thing. But at the same time, I kind of want it to be for all ages. I also want it to be for those game collectors out there. And maybe they don't have a kid yet, but they know one day they do. And I think that it's perfect for all ages. Like I try to keep my artwork at all ages anyway. But yeah, that was kind of the idea behind it, was well, I want to know my audience first, and I want it to be, you know, my son's age, maybe a little bit older, and then to start gearing towards that, choosing what moment I wanted to tell, which was Miyamoto's beginning. And then I kind of looked within that, like, okay, so what was so special about that moment? And from my research and from my understanding of the historical moment, it was Miyamoto taking a game, Radar Scope, which was going to fail with Nintendo of America. So it was kind of this emergency project. We need to replace this game
Yeah.
or it's going to fail. What are we going to do? So they just asked Miyamoto, hey, can you come up with a game to replace this? And his approach was completely different, because a lot of games at that time were, you know, clones, or Pac-Man's popular, let's do Pac-Man. Space Invaders is popular, let's do Space Invaders. Miyamoto gets the opportunity to create a game, and he goes, what can I make that's new? What can I make that's fun, has a story? So basically approaching it as like outside of the box thinking.
Yeah.
And I love that idea. Even outside of video games, like just that idea of thinking outside the box and being creative. So that felt like the perfect moment to tell and explain this historical moment, as well as there's a teaching moment in there about, he talks to his coworkers in the book about using his passion to create, using the things around him, and thinking outside of the box that way. So it's, you know, it's condensed down to a younger understanding.
Yeah.
But it still has all of that present in the book.
So what would you, how much research went into it? How much research did you have to dig through to figure out what you were going to include in the book and what you weren't? And then what was the process of deciding that, of deciding what would go into the book?
Yeah, that the research was the easy part. I already, as I mentioned before, you know, I did my master's degree thesis on historical video game preservation, specifically like contextual preservation, which seems kind of obscure, but
we were talking off mic about the Video Game History Foundation. That's their big thing, contextualizing video game history, not just here's a ROM, here's what the game was like, but understanding the story behind it.
Absolutely. Yeah, the VGHF actually came into being at the same time I was doing my thesis research. So like I was one of the first people to jump in there and start backing them. Yeah, I loved what they were doing. And they were kind of this epiphany for me as I was doing my research. But yeah, like you were saying, you know, there are pros and cons to physical preservation and digital preservation, but the one that really seems to rise above it is the contextual preservation. And I'd like to think that this book will help with that as well, this, you know, mm-hmm. this kind of contextual preservation idea. So I knew that that was kind of the backbone of this book and any future books that we can hopefully create as well. But the research side of it was easy for me. The tough part was absolutely boiling it down. I'm trying to remember the famous author. It might have been Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. There's a famous quote where he wrote a letter and said, "Sorry, this letter is so long. If I had more time, it would have been shorter." And kind of making the point that it takes more time to edit, you know, edit what you're trying to say and boil it down into what it needs to be. So that was definitely the struggle.
Because now I'm just curious. This is from, I don't know who this is. It's from DeborahYaff.com. I don't think that's who wrote it. Voltaire?
Voltaire. That sounds right.
That's right.
Because he was a comedic person as well. So that makes sense.
I can relate to that a lot. I am a very long-winded writer, and it's annoying. I much rather go and talk to someone because I can be much more succinct. Or it also... being long-winded when you're speaking doesn't sound as weird as when you're being long-winded when you're writing. So yeah. I find talking is a lot more my speed. I am not a good writer at all in the slightest. Okay. How did you determine what details to put into the book? Because like you're saying, that's the difficult part. And I could understand that, especially with how much information is out there for that moment of turning Radar Scope into Donkey Kong. And like, do you go into, I would assume you have to kind of go for a more emotional angle, because if going with technical angles, like a little kid's not going to memorize all the technical aspects of it, and the individual dates and times and all this other stuff and individual people. But so what was your process for boiling that all down?
Well, a huge sounding board for me, very supportive wife here at home, bouncing ideas off of her. She's especially helpful in the sense that I'm the one with the big gaming passion. She, you know, her upbringing, she didn't really have that kind of passion backing her up. So if I was saying things to her and bringing her ideas and they were bouncing off and she would kind of like glaze over, like, okay. Then, you know, a kid coming into this with no background is also going to glaze over. So she was a huge sounding board for me. And she's also has an art background as well. So it's very helpful to kind of use her to help me edit as well. And also having the approach of, since knowing my audience, I also knew not only did I want kind of the historical context in there, but I also wanted to have a lesson of, like I said, about, you know, how to be creative, how to maintain that creativity and to, you know, how that just makes everything better.
Yeah.
And kind of so everything, all of my kind of design decisions and writing decisions were based on that. Like, OK, does it fit into this theme that I'm going for? If it doesn't and it's not, you know, crucial, it goes away kind of thing. So. That's kind of the approach I took. And, you know, with all of the children's books I've already been reading to my son and that I read myself as a child, and bringing that experience into it as well, like, you know, this feels like this would fit in that same world sort of thing.
That's really cool. And I can really relate to the wife not getting into video games as much. That's literally the exact same dynamic my wife and I had. I've only had her on two episodes of the podcast so far. First one didn't turn out great, and it was not her fault. I picked a game that she had never even seen before and that I had never played before, and it was her first time on a podcast. But the second time I had her on for Stardew Valley, and that's a super popular episode, and it turned out really well too. I'm gonna have her back on, because did your wife have any experience like with games at all prior to you and her getting together? Like, is it like, my wife played maybe five games total.
same idea. World, her vision of video games is a specific moment during the N64 era where her little brother had an N64 in the house. So she refers to Mario 64 as just Mario. That's the Mario game for her. Banjo-Kazooie, you know, a couple of games here and there, but it's pretty much surrounded by N64 or anything that you know, that might have pervaded pop culture in general, like Donkey Kong and Tetris, that like broke out of just being in the video game realm.
I can very much relate to that. I'm looking up right now, actually. We're going to do, I guess it's a little bit of a teaser. I don't know when we're going to do this, but we're going to do another episode where I play through the games that she played as a kid that I never touched.
Ooh.
So a lot of it is PC games, and they're very much the activity centers. They're not necessarily quote unquote games, but they're kind of games at the same time. So she has Toy Story Activity Center for the Game Boy, for the PC. Mr. Potato Head Saves Veggie Valley, which I've never heard of before. And a game and a Rugrats game for the Game Boy. And there's a couple others, like a couple Mary Kate and Ashley things and whatnot. So I'm kind of looking forward to that episode. I think it'll be really cool. I don't know when we're going to do it, but I'm kind of looking forward to it.
Yeah, that sounds exciting.
So, well, since now that you've written a book and you've illustrated the book, I know it hasn't, obviously you only have, like, I guess one copy right now because it has to go into production for everybody. Did you have to change the way you did your art, your art design philosophies at all for the book from what you usually do?
Yeah, I actually changed my style quite a bit for this book. My artwork is very much inspired by and influenced by the stuff that I grew up with. So a lot of my style comes from Genndy Tartakovsky. If people are familiar with him, he's the creator of Dexter's Lab, Samurai Jack, co-created or helped with Powerpuff Girls. His art style, his storytelling, his mixture of action and comedy is something I always strive for in my own work. I was a huge Dragon Ball Z fan in high school, so Akira Toriyama's work has a huge influence on me. I was a big Ninja Turtle kid. Avatar: The Last Airbender.
That's a great show. I loved all that.
I think it's better than Harry Potter. That's my hot take.
I'm kind of with you on that, actually. My wife's the Harry Potter fan. What you can't see in the video right now, but over that way, is a whole shelf of Harry Potter stuff that my wife collects. Like, she's got a bunch of stuff. I would love to collect Avatar: The Last Airbender shenanigans, but they're not quite as popular as Harry Potter.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, supposedly there's some good books out there and some good... I've got a few of the comics that came out after the series that are really good, really well done.
Did you like Legend of Korra? I haven't finished it. I only watched the first season, just an FYI.
You know, I haven't finished it either. I have it sitting on my Blu-ray shelf, and I'm partway through the third season, and something happens where I fall off, and then... So I've got to get back into it and finish it, and just finally, so I can actually have an opinion about it that I don't have to, like, regret or be like, oh, can I really have this opinion on it? So, but I enjoy it so far.
I loved what they did with how they didn't just make it a continuation of the story with Aang and Katara and Sokka and Zuko. They kind of showed life, you know, 60 years in advance, or however, 80, I forget what the number is, but yeah, a long way in advance, or maybe 100 years, I don't remember. But I really liked that idea where it was it was so different, and it made it feel like the 1920s through 40s ish a little bit with that. Yeah, kind of went through that vibe. I really like that. So those were your influences. So what did you do to have to switch it up for the kids book?
What I ended up doing for the kids book, and this kind of came from going off of, I actually had an illustration class in grad school, and one of our assignments was doing a kind of kids book project type thing. And at the time, it was right around the time that Satoru Iwata passed away. So I was like really inspired by that and like wanting to do something. So I did like this little biography for Satoru Iwata. And when I was coming up with that, similar to this style, like I did this kind of, the only way I can describe this style is like a mixture of puppet, like old school, like Muppet style puppet, and the old school, like Mickey Mouse rubber hose style cartoon, kind of like Cuphead, like that old Fleischer style.
Yeah.
And I tried to kind of combine that, because that, thinking of those, obviously you think of like simpler times, you think of like this really heartwarming, like that's the feeling I get when I look at Muppets or when I look at those old cartoons. And that reminds me of like my even earlier childhood of watching like old Looney Tunes or old Merry Melodies. So
I love Looney Tunes so much. You don't even know.
So that's what kind of, I was like, you know, I feel like maybe if I go towards that, and even the more, and I don't think I realized I was doing it at the time until I was looking at my Miyamoto design, and I was like, wow, he looks an awful lot like Mickey Mouse or like an Animaniac, mm-hmm. that old school look to it. And I started leaning into that with my character designs. And on top of that, I really like thick outlines on my artwork, which also harkens back to like Genndy Tartakovsky's Dexter's Lab and those kind of the old cartoons.
Yeah.
On Cartoon Network had the thick outlines. But for this, I was like, let me try something different. What else feels like more heartwarming? And I wanted to give it this cut paper look, like it's cut out and pasted together. So I used filters in my software that I was using to create the artwork. And I gave them these tiny little drop shadows to make them look like they're cut paper and glued on top of each other. So like all of these changes to my design were to hopefully, you know, help reinforce the children's book aesthetic.
Yeah.
Make it feel softer, more heartwarming, that kind of thing.
It's kind of a non sequitur to it, but like, or not really related, but have you ever played Tearaway at all?
Oh, I've heard of that, but I have not.
Have you seen the art style for that?
I think so. That sounds familiar.
It's very paper craft, which is what kind of the way you were describing. It's not as cartoony as it's not as like, it's not a cartoon. It's not illustrated. It's 3D still, but it's not like it's cel shaded to kind of give it that vibe.
Right.
But it's it very much feels like this world is made out of construction paper and craft supplies, and it's adorable. It's a really cute game. If you get a chance, do you have a Vita at all?
I don't.
You could probably look up gameplay of it. They also made like a sequel-ish type of thing for the PS4 called Tearaway Unfolded. But while the art style is still the same, you kind of lose some of the charm of the gameplay, because the big thing with the Vita for the game is that whenever you control like a third-person platformer, right? But the front-facing camera is, since it's always facing you, whenever you look up at the sun, you just see your face, because it kind of centers the world, around you. And with the back touchscreen of the Vita, where you can like tap on the bottom of it, what they do it in really clever ways where it's not necessarily very gimmicky. They do it very sparingly where you might have to make your character jump. You can tap on the bottom and specific surfaces. It echoes like a drum. So it actually feels like you're hitting a drum and you hop up and whatnot. It's a really good game. I know it has nothing to do with your kid's book, but just you talking about your art style kind of reminded me that I'll send you some screenshots after we're done recording. Cause I think you'd like the art style in it, and it's a very kid friendly game. It's really cute.
Yeah, and now thinking of it, you know, another Miyamoto thing, it's kind of reminding me of like Yoshi's Island or Yoshi's Crafted World, that kind of thing.
Oh my god, I love Yoshi's Island. That game, that visuals for that game still hold up in my opinion. I think it still looks good today.
Yeah.
So what, to learn a little bit more about you, we've talked a lot about the book, but to kind of learn a little bit more about you, what first got you into video games, or what's one of your earliest gaming memories? And then after that, what got you into video game history? But let's talk about the first one.
Yeah. So getting into video games, it's so funny. Whenever I think about, you know, whenever I recall moments from the past, it's always like, oh, that's when I was playing this game, or that's the year I got this game for my birthday. So like almost all of the landmarks of my personal timeline is like built on playing video games.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember some of my earliest stuff was my parents playing Atari. That my dad was in the military for quite a while. So that was most of my life. I moved all over the place with my dad, and, you know, my whole family moved around with him, and he traded his extra uniform for an Atari. And so that's the story I was told. And so we had like this Atari with 30 games, and we'd mess around, and my parents would compete with like Frogger high scores and whatnot. And of course they'd let my older brother and I kind of mess around with it.
But the controller wasn't plugged in, was it?
Oh, I'm sure. to me, my memories, yes, I'm sure it was plugged in, but no, I doubt it. I seriously doubt it. But yeah, we'd play Atari. We played NES. I remember getting a power pad and messing around with that. And like just thinking about video games and video game history, like I feel like I grew up and matured at the same time, like alongside video games. So like the more, you know, like my awkward teenage years were the PS1 and N64 when they were going through the awkward transition into 3D. And, you know, now video games is the biggest money-making thing. It's like more than film and music combined, I think, the video game industry. Yeah.
I mean, just look at Microsoft buying Bethesda recently. I mean, it's not that new at the time of recording this, but it's like $7.5 billion for Bethesda. That's more than they paid for Star Wars. That's more than Disney paid. That's insane.
That is crazy.
And granted, I know Star Wars being bought was like, what, 10 years ago now, like 2010-ish, maybe a little earlier than that. But still, that's $7.5 billion. That's wild. So I would assume then, I'm guessing you're a little bit older than me then. Are you? Are you older than 31?
Yes, I am about to turn 34 this month as well. So.
I can relate to that timeline a little bit where you kind of grow up with the consoles. Now, I'm old enough where Super Nintendo could have been my first system, but the N64 was actually my first system. But going up through my awkward preteen years was actually mainly it was PS1. I played a lot of Final Fantasy, and it kind of worked out because I played a lot of Final Fantasy 8, so I related to the moodiness of Squall real bad. But then as I went to high school, then PS2 was my thing. So what got you into video game history first? Because I feel like everyone, where was the line that you crossed going from a video game fan to a fan of the history of it?
Yeah, this might be the same for a lot of folks in my boat, but I think it was discovering emulation.
Okay, mine's different, kind of, but yeah.
Was kind of the gateway for video game history for me because I totally was a mark for all the Sega commercials as a kid. They totally got me. Sonic was amazing and was faster and all of that. So Sega became like, oh, I got to get a Sega Genesis. I completely missed all the Super Nintendo stuff, unless, I went to a friend's house that had a Super Nintendo and played the games there. And at that point, like, there was no battle anymore for me. It was just like more video games, yes, So, but, I grew up with the Genesis. And when it was either very late middle school or very early high school, classmates of mine would be talking about old games and playing them on their computer. And it wasn't until I started digging into their conversation that they were like, yeah, you haven't heard of emulators? I'm like, no, how do I do this? You could play these games. So at that point, I became fascinated with the Nintendo back catalog and all the RPGs that I missed, especially since, I did play the Final Fantasies on PS1. Going back and being like, oh wow, now I can experience all of these previous Final Fantasies and RPGs and all of the other great stuff on Super Nintendo. So that was kind of my gateway, so to speak, into video game history. And I think it really solidified when I went to grad school because I had to come up with a thesis for, for graduating. And the summer that I came up with my thesis was, I believe it was the same GDC, the Game Developers Conference. I think that was the big one where Frank Cifaldi gave his talk on game preservation. And he threw out the stat that really hit him. And when he said it, it like blew me back. And I was like, I have to dedicate my thesis to this now. It was like this eye-opening moment. And he talked about how the film industry, the first, 20 to 40 years of its existence, 80% of it is just gone. Like, we can never experience those
That's
films. They're
so
just
wild to think
gone.
about.
And he brought up, like, this is where video games are right now. We have now had the first 30 to 40 years of video games as a form. And we are on the precipice of being in the same boat as film if we do not learn from film's mistakes. We are leaving behind all of these old games, all these old hardware, all this old stuff, because the industry is moving so fast and wanting to improve. And so, like, I was completely sold at that point. I felt like I was in video game church. Like, yes, I see the light. And so, like, I was determined at that point. I need to do, like, I'm not a programmer. I'm just a gamer and I'm an artist. What can I do to help the cause,
No, I'm with you on that. I have a very sim I don't have the same route to video game history as you, but I can relate to that desire to do more within this sphere, because I'm just a guy who likes to talk about video games, and I wouldn't really say anything that I do is classified as video game research or video game preservation. It might be a little bit more about the contextualization of it, like what we were talking about before, but that's a little bit different, because I might be talking about games that I didn't personally experience, and that doesn't help the contextualization. That just kind of adds your more outside opinion to it. I would like contextualization would be doing, talking about what the PS4 is doing right now, and like what is Xbox and Microsoft doing right now, because everyone's talking about it in the news, and all these podcasts are pretty much doing the job of that. Like, people are like throwing their two cents into the ring about like what are these console manufacturers doing, and so on and so forth. So it's I can I don't know I'm for me, what hooked me was just learning about forward-thinking concepts that you didn't realize existed in old video games. When you think of really modern gameplay aesthetics, like when you think of an open-world game that has a day and night cycle, that things change pretty much, fluidly, switching one to the other and learning about the world, you think a lot of, Grand Theft Auto or Horizon Zero Dawn or stuff like that. I was shocked to learn that, we mentioned it before, Castlevania II: Simon's Quest has that exact same thing. It's an open world game with a day and night cycle. And you don't think about that on the NES, because, I mean, it didn't do it well, but it did it. It has like this weird forward thinking progress. So it's, I like dissecting games like that. That's kind of like my angle to it, where it's, I like to look at old games and be like, well, how does this like, what things did they do that were so ahead of its time that you don't really expect it to do? I mean, even if you look back on the Atari and you look, I haven't played this game, but the Indiana Jones games, Raiders of the Lost Ark, I think, where you had to use one joystick to manage the inventory and the other joystick to control Indy, and but you had two separate controllers because you couldn't, you know, there was only just one joystick and a button on the Atari 2600. Yep. So it's stuff like that where it's like, how did they figure this shit out? Like, it's just, it's funny to me that you can look back at that and see all the building blocks of what we have now just done in such a primitive way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Primitive in quotations.
And I love, don't get me wrong, I love all games, and I love my Switch that I've got, my Nintendo Switch, that's great. But at the same time, kind of like what you're saying, you know, looking back, it reminds me of, there's a documentary, I believe it's called Format the Planet.
Okay.
It's more about chiptune music and the birth of that.
Sorry, that music. Was my phone.
It's all right. Yeah, it's called Format the Planet, I believe.
I was trying to write it down, but and then I dropped my phone. I'm Googling it right now, so that way I don't forget it.
Yeah, yeah.
Reformat
the Planet. Okay.
There we go.
And it's really a great documentary, kind of talking about the chiptune movement of music and how it kind of grew out of this passion for video games and music, and like kind of surpassed that into just being a genre of music. But it's really interesting, like seeing the different artists and everything. But one of them, I can't remember which artist, I feel bad now, but he made his music using Game Boy. And he talked about how...
By any chance?
What's
that?
I don't
know. Chipocrit, maybe? He does that.
It might have been Chipocrit. It might have been Chipocrit. That sounds familiar. He was being, you know, they interviewed all these artists, and it was either him or someone, yeah, it might have been Chipocrit, said that, you know, we're moving on to all these different, you know, hardware and everything, but no one's actually perfected the old stuff yet. You know, and like the thought of, that's another thing that kind of got me into video game history, is the thought of all like the lost potential. Like, think of all that, and like what you're saying about, you know, people were trying to figure out day and night cycles on the NES, you know, that, and that whole, you know, the, what is that, necessity is the birth of invention. Is that the quote? Mm-hmm. Something like that.
I always, my go-to is limitations breed creativity.
Yeah, absolutely. So like forcing yourself to like, yeah, we can we get this to work faster? Can we get more space on this disc? Like, well, hold on. What can we accomplish, you know, with the stuff beforehand? And like I said, I'm all for new games. I love new games, but there's something really special about people, you know, surpassing these limitations using the old stuff. And so like all this great chiptune music is happening on these old things that, you know, people have moved on using new technology, but, you know, there's great potential being left behind.
What are some of your favorite eras of video game history? Like, I feel like everyone has, like, you know, it's probably your nostalgic sweet spot, but yeah. If you had to choose one, let's go with this. If you had to choose one that wasn't in your nostalgic sweet spot, like something that you don't get warm, fuzzy feelings about, what would it be? For me personally, it would actually be early to late NES, because I was born in 89, so I didn't get to experience the NES in its heyday in the slightest. You know, I was born 4 years after the release in North America, and by the time I became cognizant of anything, Super Nintendo was practically on its way out, and N64 was here.
Yeah, oh man. Yeah, because me, like, that's still nostalgic for me, because I still have my memories of going to Toys R Us or KB Toys and like picking a game and like the excitement of bringing it home and opening it up and maybe the letdown of like, this game is very hard, instead of, you know, the understanding that this game is bad and dealing with that. Oh, man, I still have nostalgia for that.
You know what? Because maybe because you even said beforehand, you got to experience the Atari 2600. So you pretty much covered, even though you're not as old as the 2600, you still pretty much covered it. So what would be your favorite? Let's put nostalgia back into it. So like, what would be your favorite era?
the warmest fuzzies I get are around Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time for me.
Really? Okay.
Yes, because first of all, my N64, the funny thing is like I've separated myself enough at this point. It's been over 20 years that like I can look back and be like, yeah, that's not the best Nintendo system. But at the same time, I mowed so many lawns to save up money for an N64. So that was the first system that I had actively like, I'm looking forward to this system. I'm going to save up money for this system. My parents actually, you can say, tricked me. I'd actually saved up enough money from mowing lawns to buy a Nintendo 64 on my own. And it was almost Christmas time, and they had told me, like, well, you should save up a little bit more so you can get a game or two to go with it. And so, okay, yeah, I'll do that. Little did I know they'd already bought one for me. Like, they'd seen all the work I was putting into it.
Yeah.
They bought one for me, so I was able to use all the money I saved up on games anyway if I wanted to do that kind of thing. But so that's really special, warm and fuzzies for me. And spending, like, my first memories of spending time on the internet was researching Ocarina of Time before that came out. Because that came out after I'd gotten my N64. So that was, like, the first marquee game that I was really looking forward to. And, like, reading an article about, you're going to get a horse in this game. And my brain could not wrap around the idea of riding on Zelda. Because, like, I'm still thinking of top-down Zelda. You know, I know it's in 3D, but my brain doesn't know what that looks like because I'm not seeing screenshots. So I'm still thinking of top-down, and it's like, yeah, you get to traverse Hyrule on a horse. And I'm like, so are you just like whipping through the screens? Because I'm still thinking of the screen having to move with you, you know, one screen at a time, the old school Zelda games. So like, I'm probably, I'm 11 at the time, 12, reading these articles, just like excitedly going to sleep at night with visions of what this game is going to look like. And totally like psyching myself up. So that's like the warmest fuzzies, because that's like early internet, the first system I saved up money for, like this huge Zelda game that I'm learning about. So that's kind of like this really sweet spot in the formation of me as a person.
Zelda 64, especially Ocarina, is just, it was my first Zelda game, so I can understand that fuzzies. Now years later, I look back on it, while I still like it, it's nowhere near my favorite Zelda anymore, but it's still like a really good game. So I can understand that, because I can relate to that so much, because I remember, it's weird because you're saying that's your first forays into the internet. It was kind of like that for me, but not quite, because we still had dial-up at the time, and it was not quite. Since I am younger than you by like 3 years, I wasn't really allowed to do too much on the internet. I was still like, I was like 8 or 9 years old around that same time then. But I remember getting an email address. I think I was playing Ocarina of Time around the same age that you were, but obviously just a couple years later. And there was a friend of mine who, he unfortunately passed away really young, so I think that's also one of the reasons why Ocarina of Time sticks into my head, because like, he was a couple years older than me, and he passed away from bacterial meningitis, which I learned what that was at a very young age. And I still have emails on my old email account from him asking him, how do you get past Dodongos? Because I didn't understand that you had to run around and hit them in the tails. And then he's like, you just dodge the fire and do this. I'm like, oh, okay. Because I kept smacking him on the head, and I couldn't figure it out. And so that game, it reminds me of my first forays into the internet. Because I also remembered he was the first kid I ever saw using AOL Instant Messenger. I remember going over to his house, and he was in their computer room talking to people on Instant Messenger. I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, don't bother me right now. He was never that. Actually, he was never like that. But it's weird. It's weird because I'm sorry. I know this is kind of random. We're here to talk about you. I'm just all this is hitting me right now. That kid influenced so much of my life, because he was the first one that I ever saw like Mario at, like Super Nintendo, like a Super Nintendo and original NES. First time I ever saw Duck Hunt was at his house. He also, he would babysit us every now and then, which is weird because he died when he was in eighth grade. I'm just picturing, and he was younger than us, so that means he was like in sixth or seventh grade. So he was probably pretty, it's a little young to be babysitting kids.
Yeah.
At least now that I think about it. So he was probably pretty young, but he babysat us and showed me the Three Ninjas movies. I don't know if you ever saw those.
Yes, I love those.
Do you have those?
Yes, I think I've got all four of them on VHS, in fact.
Yes, I want to do it. I tried so hard. I don't know if I'll ever get the chance to. I tried to reach out to one of the actors on it to get them on the podcast because there's a couple of video games based off of Kickback or whatever.
Nice. That would be awesome. Yeah.
He didn't respond, but it was okay. but anyway, I'm sorry. That was a complete tangent. We're here to talk about your book. But going down memory lane just kind of reminded me of that. So I don't really have much else to ask you, but is there anything that you would like to say about your book that we just haven't got into? Like, I feel like I asked you about your art styles for it, your research that went into it, your inspiration. Is there anything else about the book that you would like to talk about that I just neglected to bring up?
I guess my main thing would be if folks are excited about this one book, I'd like to hope that they'd be excited about the idea of having more stories, video game stories being told in this way. Because like I said, when I looked into it, I didn't really find anything. Like, first of all, I didn't really find any video game children's books. There's not a lot of those out there. Like, there might be children's books where someone gets sucked into a video game or something like that. But there's not really anything specifically about video games or about, and in this case, video game history. So if that's something that a void that you either wanted filled or now are realizing that you wanted filled, I'd love to keep doing this, find other stories other than Miyamoto. I've been reaching out and talking to, like I said, or like you were talking about, our mutual friend Game Dave, about collaborating as well. So I would love to continue telling these stories, and maybe Miyamoto isn't your bag, but maybe Final Fantasy is. That's something that Game Dave and I are looking into, continuing this children's book line, and if not that, maybe something else. If this idea is tickling something in your brain to the listeners out there, I would love to expand this. I would love to get this to a point where you listening, like, that there's something that you really want to see in a kid's book form. And if this can continue going, I feel pretty confident that I could get to something that somebody likes. And so there's these, this opportunity for kid's books. And I guess the other thing I can talk about as well is talking to other people in my boat with having a young kid, being a gamer. Same thing with Game Dave. He's got his young son. Same thing with you. Congratulations, by the way, coming up. Yeah, his Game Boy. but, the conversation always comes up between folks like us. Like, how are you going to introduce your kid to video games? Are you going to just let them have the newest thing? Are you going to make them go through the history, make them play Atari first and work their way up? If that's too loaded of a question, why not a kid's book? Why not introduce them, ease them into it, and if that interests them, then it's a little bit easier to figure out, like, okay, maybe I do start them with Nintendo or start them with PS1 or, something like that. It'll start to kind of maybe interest them. So, and it's not as forceful as, like, play this, here's a Game Boy, go play it, come back to me.
Oh, I already know which console I'm starting my kid on.
Definitely. Oh, yeah.
N64 for this reason only. I would actually go back earlier because I think there's a larger variety of better games on the Super Nintendo and NES, but 3D gaming is something that's very hard for people to master. So the earlier you can get someone on 3D controls and understanding, maybe even PS2. But the only reason I want to do N64 or PS1 is because they N64 and PS1, because the controls are so bad that if they can get good on them, well, I shouldn't say they're so bad, but they're nowhere near as refined as they are now. if they can get good on them, then going back to 2D is going to be easy. And then going forward in 3D is also going to be easy. I've talked about it before. I think we were talking off mic about Retronauts, and they brought up the fact that the jump from 2D to 3D gaming alienated so many people from the get-go. Because if you look at a lot of the sales of Mario games after Super Mario World and Yoshi's Island and whatnot, it's gone down. When has it gone back up? When they went back to 2D.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I think, in fact, Shigeru Miyamoto, I think, points that out all the time, that, like, most people talk about how huge of a revolution Mario 64 was, but unfortunately for a lot of creators, including him, all he sees is the failure that he lost so many gamers with that by transitioning it to 3D. And I think that was a big reason why it took them a long time to go back to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think they finally, now that you have enough kids who are growing up with 3D gaming, it's nowhere near that drop. Like, Mario Odyssey was a huge hit. Even Galaxy was a huge hit, but still, by comparison, it didn't outsell New Super Mario Bros. Or anything like that. So it's coming around now, but yeah, that transition was rough. So I figure if you get them used to 2D and then jump them over to 3D, it's going to be a lot harder of a transition for them versus going back to 2D, because it's a lot less you have to worry about in terms of controls.
That's true.
That's just, that's my theory. I do actually have another question for you, and it just popped into my head though before we wrap up. You were talking before about wanting to do more books in the series. Would you ever, like, because that's like you were saying, you want to see more go around, would you say Satoru Iwata is one of those?
Yeah, that would be, I would love to kind of go back to the kind of pseudo genesis of this idea and maybe do something for Iwata, because I've got some older illustrations that were before I kind of came up with this style of Iwata, and it's him showing how he programmed the physics for Balloon Kid, and how he worked with HAL Laboratories, and how I've got an image of him working together for the first time with Miyamoto on a it's like an off-road game. I'm trying to remember what it was called now. I can't think of it off the top of my head.
I don't know it.
But yeah, I would love to go back. I think that he might be one of the most important figures, especially in Nintendo's history, for not necessarily, I mean, obviously for what he brought to the industry, but also for the type of person that he was. I think it's really important for people and kids to learn from. I think he has a lot to teach from the way that he lived his life and ran the company, you know, and a lot of the decisions he made were kind of against the grain for the normal culture in the previous culture. And he kind of paved a way for, like, I'm the president, but I'm a gamer, you know, that famous quote of his. So I would love to do something to, you know, teach folks about that, about him, as well as kind of honor him and what he did a little bit.
I just, even thinking about Iwata, it's weird because when he passed away, I wasn't that big into Nintendo, because he passed away, 2014, something like that? Can't remember.
That sounds right. 2014, 2015, somewhere in there.
I'll double check on that just because I don't want to get corrected. But when he passed away, it was 2015, July 11th, 2015. Okay. When he passed away, I wasn't necessarily the biggest Nintendo fan at that moment, just because the Wii U was fine, but it, you know, it was pretty much a flop. And I was definitely much more into PS3 and Xbox, or I guess PS4 and Xbox One at the time. But I still was like, Nintendo is something where it's like, the older I get, the more I like Nintendo, because it's their stuff is so much more innocent.
Timeless.
Yeah, timeless and innocent. Because it just made it, like, when you play like Call of Duty, even though it's fun and whatnot, it's still it's still war. Like, it's still a war simulator, and you're still kind of having that in your mind where it's a very intense game. And Mario and Zelda, even though there's intense moments of it, it feels a lot less serious in that intensity, if that makes sense. And so when Iwata passed away, I had this, I even when I think about it, I get this weird tinge of sadness, because even though I wasn't as connected to Nintendo and I didn't know much about him when he passed away, because that was before I was really into any sorts of video game history. That was kind of like the start of it. It was like maybe a year or two in. That was when did I start my podcast? I just didn't know much about Iwata. Like, I knew he was the president, but I didn't know all the amazing things about him just because I hadn't researched it. And now when I bring it up, it makes me wonder what could have been, you know, like where, and Nintendo's doing well. So it's not like having him would have corrected a course that they needed to be corrected. It's more just like, what new directions would he have pushed the industry that we didn't see coming? Cause he's one of the main people who figured out the Switch, or who like inspired the Switch. And that's kind of like his last, that's kind of like his send off.
Yeah.
Posthumous send off, but a send off.
Right.
Anyway, I don't have anything else for you. So Dexter, thank you so much for joining me on this episode. It was, I know I kind of talked a little bit more about myself than I wanted to on that little section, but I really do like your book idea. I loved seeing it, the Kickstarter video for it. I'm really excited. I'm hoping it gets, I hope it gets funded. I really want this funded. So anyone listening, please go support this Kickstarter. I'm going to include a link in the podcast description. I'm also going to include a link on the social media stuff for when this episode goes out. But for those who don't know or don't know where to find it, Dexter, where can everyone find you on the internet, and where can they find your Kickstarter?
Yeah, it should be, I want to make sure I get this right. So, yeah, if you go on to Kickstarter and if you search for Mr. Miyamoto or video game history in an illustrated children's book, you know, if you search under that kind of thing, it should pop up. You can also search for kickstarter.com/project/bite-sized books, and spelled bite-sized with a Y, BYTE-SIZED BOOKS. That's going to be kind of the banner that this is going to be published under. So you could check it out there. You can also follow, I'll be posting stuff online. I have a page on Facebook, Dexter Morals Art, so you can search for me on there. The last name is Morrill, so it doesn't really spell like it sounds, but Dexter Morals Art on Facebook. You can find me on Instagram at Dex Moral. Same thing on Twitter. You can find me on there. That's most of my posts right now are about that. So if you want to see some artwork, some fun stuff, I've been trying to post little fun facts, post little snippets of artwork, things like that to keep people excited about the project. But I also have a website. It's my name with a hyphen in the middle, dexter-moral.com. I've got more artwork on there if you would like to see some more samples of some of the work I've done. Gosh, almost 10 years ago now, I used to work with RetrowareTV.com, if anyone's familiar with that.
The video website. Game years. That's what I know them
for. Yes. Yeah, back when they were doing the video game years, I was doing a webcomic for their website at the time. And so I was able to work with folks like Pixel Dan, Norm the Gaming Historian, Pat the NES Punk, Game Dave. That's how I got to meet a lot of these great folks. And I know I'm leaving some people out, but I've worked specifically with those individuals doing artwork for them as well. I actually helped design the first DVD for the video game years, like the art for that.
I have that DVD downstairs, actually.
On the inside on there, I'm credited in there, like really small. You'll see my name in there.
I'm going to go check that out then.
I did the DVD cover for Pat's Volume 3 of his DVD, I believe. Done some title cards for Pixel Dan's From Plastic to Pixels when he did that with Norm. Done some promo stuff for Norm as well. But I do my best to keep in touch with those folks. You know, if we're lucky, they might be involved in the future as well. So keep your eyes peeled. So if any of those names kind of had you perk up your ears, listeners, you know... or you can also shout out to them too, like, hey, are you going to do a book? You know, you can poke them too. You can poke them too. You can say that I sent you if you want. But yeah, so I've kind of got a background in this. If you enjoy my artwork, please let me know. I'm always doing this stuff. I'm teaching on the side as well. So that's kind of how I make my bones, but I like to draw. I like to illustrate. I like to design. I love comics. I love video games, and I love talking about all of it. So I really appreciate you having me on, and I'm really excited for folks to see this. You know, if nothing else, I really want this, you know, to get out there and share with folks, and being on here is a huge help for that. So thank you very much.
Thank you for coming on. And thank you again. I know it was really last minute, but I wanted to get this out in time before the Kickstarter ended, so people have plenty of time to go check it out, and hopefully they better back it. not threatening in the slightest. As usual for me, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. You can email me, StillLoadingContact@gmail.com. You can also go to my website, StillLoadingPodcast.com. If you want to support the show, you can do that in a number of ways. You can give it a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. That does help the show's exposure, and it helps more people find it, so please consider doing that. If you want to support it monetarily, you can go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod. Even just $1 a month will help me grow the show. You can also check out the network I'm a part of, the Podbeard Network. Go to podbeardnetwork.com and check out all the podcasts on there. And the most important shout out, besides the Kickstarter that I have for this, is the nonprofit I'm partnered with, the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals and children's hospitals. So if you want to check them out and consider donating, you can go to bitbybitfoundation.org. And yeah, that should do it. Dexter, seriously, thank you again. It was really fun talking to you and getting to know you, you know, before this. And I would love to actually have you back on again, even if it's not for a project, we can pick a topic and BS about it. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. No, I love talking video games any chance I get. So even if the book wasn't kind of the goal here to chat about, yeah, I'd love to talk more about games.
And that will do it for this episode. So thank you all for listening. Thank you, Dexter. And I will see you all next time.